Hello, listeners. If you are enjoying this podcast without commercial interruption and are financially able, please consider supporting our effort. To contribute, go to the homepage, spacerockethistory.com, and click on the orange donate button or the Patreon link. Thanks. Hello and welcome. This is Michael Annis, and you're listening to episode number 435 of the Space Rocket History Podcast. And now, Soyuz 12 and 13. I hope you recall the Soyuz 11 disaster, which I covered in episodes 333 through 334. In case you don't, in 1971, the entire three-man crew of Soyuz 11 died on the return trip from Salyut. None of the cosmonauts were wearing spacesuits during reentry because of the capsule having been originally planned for two persons with pressure suits, but for political purposes, the Soviets wanted the capsule to hold three cosmonauts in order to be comparable with the Apollo capsule. Unfortunately, to make this change for 2 to 3 cosmonauts, there would not be enough room for the cosmonauts to wear pressure suits. So the Soyuz was designed to hold 3 cosmonauts without pressure suits. Unfortunately, this decision would eventually come back to haunt the Soviets with Soyuz 11. When Soyuz 11 began re-entry, the capsule's atmosphere was rapidly lost, and the three cosmonauts, not having suits, all asphyxiated. After the Soyuz 11 disaster, the Soviets decided that they needed to redesign the Soyuz 7K OKS spacecraft used for Soyuz 11 to correct their error. The new spacecraft was called the Soyuz 7KT and was meant to be used on future Salyut space station missions. I'm sure you recall that the Soyuz spacecraft is composed of three elements attached end to end: the orbital module, the descent module, and the instrumentation slash propulsion module. The crew occupied the central element, the descent module. The other two modules were jettisoned prior to re-entry, and they burn up in the atmosphere, so only the descent module returns to Earth intact. Now, this second generation of the Soyuz spacecraft, the Soyuz 7KT, was flown on Soyuz missions 12 through Soyuz 40, and that occurred between 1973 and 1981. The new 7KT spacecraft was designed to accommodate only two cosmonauts, who would wear pressure suits at all times during launch, docking, undocking, and re-entry. As an extra precaution, the place of the third cosmonaut was taken by extra life support systems. Furthermore, the 7KT, being intended purely as a space station ferry, had no solar panels. Instead, two large whip antennas were installed in their place. Since it didn't have solar panels, it relied on batteries, which only provided enough power for 2 days of standalone flight. The plan was that the Soyuz would recharge its batteries while docked with a Salyut space station. But in the event of a docking or other mission failure, which ended up happening on several occasions, the crew was forced to power off everything except communications and life support systems until they could re-enter the atmosphere. two test flights of the 7KT were conducted prior to committing the redesigned Soyuz to a crewed mission. Cosmos 496 was launched on June 26, 1972, and spent a week in space, part of it in power-down mode. Then on September 2, 1972, an attempted launch of a Zenit reconnaissance satellite failed to orbit due to a malfunction of the Venera engines on the Block A stage. The existing stock of Soyuz boosters had to be modified to prevent a recurrence of this failure mode on a crewed mission, which delayed the next test until almost a year later with Cosmos 573, launched on June 15, 1973, and it spent 2 days in space. With this done, the way was cleared for the first crewed test, Soyuz 12, in September 1973. Soyuz 12 had a crew of two men. The commander of the mission was Vasily Lazarev. Lazarev was born in Poroshino, Altay Krai, Russia, on February 23, 1928. In 1951, he graduated from Higher Air Force School with a doctorate degree of medicine, then served as a physician for the Soviet Air Force. He eventually rose to the rank of colonel of the Soviet Air Force. In fact, Vasily Lazarev became the first Soviet Soyuz commander who was both a military pilot and a medical doctor. On May 26, 1964, he was selected as a cosmonaut. In 1966, he was assigned to the Voskhod project for OKB-3. He went through cosmonaut basic training from January of 1966 through December of 1967. He served as backup on many crews until he got his first flight on Soyuz 12 in 1973. And then he served on many more backup crews. But he is best remembered for surviving the April 5, 1975 abort of Soyuz 18A flight. Soyuz 18A, also known as the April 5th anomaly, was an unsuccessful launch of a crewed Soyuz spacecraft by the Soviet Union in 1975. The mission was expected to dock with the orbiting Salyut 4 space station, but due to failure of the Soyuz launch vehicle, the crew failed to make orbit. The crew consisted of Vasily Lazarev and the flight engineer, Oleg Markarov, a civilian. Although the mission was aborted and did not accomplish its objective, the craft exceeded common space boundaries and was recognized as a suborbital spaceflight, which the crew survived. During the abort, the crew experienced 21.3 Gs. The crew, who initially feared they had landed in China, did not, and were successfully recovered. The accident was partly disclosed by the normally secretive Soviets as it occurred during preparations for their joint Apollo-Soyuz test project with the United States, which flew 3 months later. Lazarev never flew to space again and never fully recovered from the accident. Markarov made two more flights on board a Soyuz, both of which were to the Salyut 6 space station. Now, Vasily remained in the space program until failing a physical in 1981. The problem was he never fully recovered from the injuries sustained on Soyuz 18A. After Vasily retired from active duty, he worked as a civil servant. Sadly, Lazarev died in Moscow on the last day of 1990 at the age of 62. The cause was alcohol poisoning. He was awarded the title of Hero of the Soviet Union, the title Pilot Cosmonaut of the USSR, and the Order of Lenin. Now, the flight engineer for Soyuz 12 was the aforementioned Oleg Makarov. Makarov was born in Udomia, Tver Oblast, Soviet Union, on January 6, 1933. He graduated from Bauman Moscow Higher Technical School in 1957 and started working at the OKB-1 Design Bureau, which is now called RSC Inertia, as an engineer working on the Vostok spacecraft. In 1966, he was selected for cosmonaut training. He was originally part of the Soviet Lunar Program and was training with Alexei Leonov for the first human circumlunar flight. After the success of Apollo 8, however, the flight was canceled. His first space flight was Soyuz 12. His second flight was the abortive Soyuz 18A. That I mentioned that was had an emergency landing in the Altay Mountains 21 minutes after launch. With his third launch on Soyuz 27 in January 1978, he flew to the space station Salyut 6 and landed 5 days later with the Soyuz 26 spacecraft. In November of 1980, he flew his last mission, Soyuz T-3, during which several repairs of Salyut 6 were done. He also served on the backup crews for Soyuz 17 and Soyuz T2. Altogether, he spent 20 days, 17 hours, and 44 minutes in space. After his final space flight, he continued to work for Inertia, both in the Mir space station program as well as the Inertia Buran development. His hobbies were chess, hockey, theater, reading, and traveling. He died in Moscow in 2003 from a heart attack. He was awarded twice Hero of the Soviet Union, Pilot Cosmonaut of the Soviet Union, 4 Orders of Lenin, and Order of the Blue Nile of Ethiopia. Okay, with the preliminaries out of the way, let's continue with the Soyuz 12 mission. As the first crewed test of the new version of the Soyuz space station ferry craft, Soyuz 12 was to have flown to a Salyut station, but the failures of Salyut 2 on April 4, 1973 and Cosmos 557 on May 11, 1973 in the months previous meant that there was no station for the craft to dock with. And since this Soyuz 7KT service module had no solar panels, carrying only batteries for power instead, flight duration was limited to about 2 days, enough time for a journey to and from a space station. Cosmonauts Lazarev and Makarov did get to wear pressure suits for launch and reentry, and would have worn them if they had docked at a station. On September 27, 1973, Soyuz 12 was successfully launched from Baikonur Cosmodrome. The new spacecraft was maneuvered to a 326 by 344 kilometer orbit on the second day in space, which later proved to be the standard orbit for the Salyut 4 space station. A multispectral camera in the orbital module was used in coordination with aircraft to photograph the Earth. The Soviets reported that the intention of the camera was merely to survey crops and forest conditions. The cosmonauts also tested using a Molniya 1 satellite to communicate with ground stations when their Soyuz was out of range. After their 2-day mission was complete, the deorbit burn was begun and lasted 188 seconds. After shedding 2/3 of its mass, the Soyuz reached entry interface, a point 400,000 feet or 121.9 kilometers above the Earth, where friction due to the thickening atmosphere began to heat its outer surfaces. With only 23 minutes left before the descent module was scheduled to land on the grassy plains of Central Asia, attention in the module turned to slowing its rate of descent. 8 minutes later, the spacecraft was streaking through the sky at a rate of 755 feet, or 230 meters, per second. However, before it touched down, its speed slowed to only 5 feet, or 1.5 meters per second, and it landed at an even lower speed than that. Several onboard features ensured that the vehicle and the crew landed safely and in relative comfort. 4 parachutes deployed 15 minutes before landing, dramatically slowing the vehicle's rate of descent. 2 pilot parachutes were the first to be released, and a drogue chute attached to the second one followed immediately after. The drogue measured 24 square meters or 258 square feet in area. It slowed the rate of descent from 755 feet or 230 meters per second to 262 feet or 80 meters per second. The main parachute was the last to emerge. It is the largest chute with a surface area of 10,764 square feet or 1,000 square meters. It harnesses shifted the vehicle's attitude to a 30-degree angle relative to the ground, dissipating heat, and then shifted it again to the straight vertical descent prior to landing. The main chute slowed the Soyuz to a descent rate of only 24 feet or 7.3 meters per second, which was still too fast for a comfortable landing. Therefore, 1 second before touchdown, 2 sets of 3 small engines on the bottom of the vehicle fired, slowing the vehicle to soften the landing. The crew landed 400 kilometers southwest of Karaganda on September 29, 1973. And the mission was called Flawless. Curiously, a large object was jettisoned when the spacecraft was preparing for retrofire. The object remained in orbit for 116 days. And that is the story of Soyuz 12. Now, Soyuz 13. Soyuz 13 launched only 2.5 months after Soyuz 12 in December of 73. It was the second test flight of the redesigned Soyuz 7KT spacecraft that first flew as Soyuz 12. But Soyuz 13 was specially modified to carry the Orion 2 Space Observatory. The flight was crewed by Pyotr Klimuk, Vitaly Lebedev. It was the Soviet Union's first dedicated science mission and was the first mission controlled by the new Kaliningrad Mission Control Center. The flight crew for this mission were quite accomplished and had impressive careers, and they deserve to be recognized on this podcast. I will start with the commander of the mission, Pyotr Klimuk. Pyotr Klimuk was born to a peasant family on June 10, 1942, in the village of Komarovka in the Brest region of the Belarusian Soviet Socialist Republic, currently the Republic of Belarus. His father was lost in 1944 during World War II. In 1959, he graduated from middle school and entered primary aviation school, and then attended Leninsky Komsomol Chernigov High Aviation School. After graduation in 1964, he served with the Soviet Air Force. In 1965, he was accepted into the Soviet Cosmonaut Unit, called the 1965 Air Force Group No. 3. He underwent the full General Space Preparation Course and trained for spaceflight on Soyuz-type spacecraft and on the orbital station Salyut. He performed his first flight on December 18th through the 26th, 1973, as commander of Soyuz 13, together with Lebedev. His space flight lasted 7 days, 20 hours, 55 minutes, and 35 seconds. In January 1975, he was the commander of the support crew, together with Vitaly Savastyanov, during the Soyuz 17 flight. In April 1975, he was the commander of the reserve crew for Soyuz 18-1 flight. He made his second space flight from May 24th through July 26, 1975, together with Vitaly Sevastyanov. During that flight, he served as commander of the spacecraft Soyuz 18-2 and the orbital complex Salyut 4. Soyuz 18-2 had a duration of 63 days, 23 hours, 20 minutes, and 8 seconds. Since 1976, he underwent preparations, according to the program Intercosmos, for cooperations with socialist countries. In 1977, he graduated from a Gagarin Air Force Academy. He made his third space flight from June 27th through July 5th, 1978, as commander of the Soyuz 30, together with Polish commander Mirosław Hrmuzewski. This was the second manned space flight of the Intercosmos program. Cosmonauts worked on board the orbital complex Salyut 6, Soyuz 29, and Soyuz 30 together with Vladimir Kovalennikov and Alexander Ivanchenkov. Their stay in space was 7 days, 22 hours, 2 minutes, and 59 seconds. During his three flights, Klimuk spent 78 days, 18 hours, 18 minutes, and 42 seconds in space. In 1978, he left the cosmonaut team. He served as assistant to the chief of the Gagarin Cosmonaut Training Center for Political Work from 1978 to 1991. In 1983, he graduated from the Lenin Military Political Academy. Since 1991, he served as chief of the Gagarin Cosmonaut Training Center until he retired. He is the author of two books on human spaceflight. They were called Beside the Stars and Attack on Weightlessness. He was awarded twice the title Hero of the Soviet Union. He was awarded three Orders of Lenin, the Polish Order of Krest Grunwald, Tiakovsky Gold Medal from the USSR Academy of Sciences, Gagarin Gold Medal, the gold medal from Poland's Academy of Sciences, and many more. Now let's move on to the flight engineer for Soyuz 13, Vitaly Lebedev. Lebedev was born April 14, 1942, in Moscow. After graduation from high school, Vitaly studied for a year, 1960, at the Higher Air Force Navigator School in Orenburg, but he was discharged as a result of an armed forces reduction. He continued his studies at the Moscow Aviation Institute, from which he graduated in 1966. In 1975, Lebedev defended his PhD thesis on methods of formation of the dynamic test bench for the base service of spaceship and crew training. In 1985, he defended his doctoral thesis on methods of carrying of astrophysical explorations aboard orbital stations. During his cosmonaut career, after his graduation from Moscow Aviation Institute, Lebedev worked for 23 years at the Central Design Bureau, called Energy, of the Soviet Scientific Production Union as an engineer, senior research fellow, and a methodology instructor in cosmonaut detachment. In 1967, Lebedev participated in an expedition of the 8th Naval Squadron to locate, rescue, and rehabilitate the spaceship Zond after its landing in the Indian Ocean. In 1968, Lebedev led the scientists in Bombay supporting Zond 5, which flew around the moon and returned to Earth. He continued leading technical detachments in the flying, design, testing, and control of the spaceship Soyuz and Soyuz-T, and the orbiting space stations Salyut 4, 5, and 6. Vitaly Lebedev trained as a cosmonaut from 1971 through 73 at the Yuri Gagarin Center for Cosmonaut Training. He earned a diploma in 1972, given the title of Cosmonaut Investigator, and taken on the cosmonauts team ZKBEM. His first space flight was with Peter Klimuk as the crew engineer aboard Soyuz 13, which orbited Earth from December 18th through the 26th of 1973. After this space flight, Lebedev was awarded the Gold Medal Hero of the Soviet Union, the Order of Lenin, and promoted to the rank of pilot cosmonaut. In 1982, Lebedev, along with Berezovoy, spent 211 days in space, May 13th through December 10th, as a crew engineer of the space station Salyut 7. During the mission, Lebedev conducted more than 300 scientific experiments and studies. The 211-day flight was a record for that time and recorded in the Guinness Book of Records. During that flight, an additional entry into the Guinness Book of Records was filed under the first species of plant to flower in space, with his Arab Edopsis flowered in July. After that space flight, Lebedev was awarded a second gold medal, Hero of the Soviet Union, and a second Order of Lenin. Lebedev retired from the space program in 1993, and in 2000, he became the first cosmonaut ever elected to the Russian Academy of Science. In his scientific careers following his second return from space, Lebedev became renowned as a specialist in the field of cosmonautics and geoinformation. From 1989 until 1991, Vitaly Lebedev worked as deputy director of science at the Institute of Geography. At the same time, he was acting director of Geoinformation Center, which was part of this institute. Lebedev is the author of 157 scientific works. He's the author and co-author of 9 books and 2 school textbooks for the Moscow Aviation Institute, 27 articles in Science and Life magazine, and a large number of publications in domestic and foreign press. Lebedev was also awarded 26 author certificates for inventions introduced in the Soyuz and Salyut missions. Lebedev is married and has 1 son, and he has 2 grandchildren. He has won numerous honors and awards, twice Hero of the Soviet Union, pilot cosmonaut of the USSR, Order for the Merit to the Fatherland, 2 Orders of Lenin, the Medal for Merit in Space Exploration, Medal for the Construction of the Baikal-Amur Railway, an honored scientist of the Russian Federation, officer of the Legion of Honor, France. He even has an asteroid named after him. He is even an honorary citizen of 16 Russian cities, several CIS countries, the state of Texas, and the city of Fort Worth. Now, that's an impressive career. Okay, let's move on to the mission. First, a little background information. On July 29, 1972, the failed launch of the Soviet DOS-2 space station resulted in the loss of the second copy of the Orion 1 ultraviolet telescope, which was one of the primary scientific payloads aboard the ill-fated orbital lab. The first instrument had previously been installed on the first Salyut space station and returned very promising data. Shortly after the botched DOS-2 launch, Vasily Mishin, the head of OKB-1 Design Bureau responsible for the Soviet space program, called Grigor Guzaidrin from the Baikurin Observatory in Armenia, who led the development of the Orion, and Mishin offered Gruzaidin another opportunity to fly his relatively compact instrument on one of the Soviet's Soyuz vehicles, freed as a result of the space station loss. The astronomer obviously agreed and immediately departed for Moscow for hammering out the required specifications. While still on the plane, Gruzaidin sketched a more capable instrument, which would be ultimately dubbed Orion 2. Its mass increased from 130 for the original telescope on Salyut 1 and DOS 2 to 300 kilograms. Surprisingly, it still could be fit in the Soyuz spacecraft. Using the Smit-Cassegrain optical system, the Orion 2 was capable of capturing ultraviolet radiation from hundreds of celestial objects simultaneously without filtering out the effects of the Earth's atmosphere. By varying the exposures from 1 to 18 minutes, the Orion 2 could produce spectra from the brightest objects down to the minuscule 13th magnitude, or thousands of times weaker than visibly by the naked eye. Additionally, the Orion 2 payload included a G27 and G27A spectrographs for star imaging, as well as the G35 camera for X-ray imaging of the sun. Unfortunately, the capabilities of the Soyuz spacecraft, first of all, its life support system, limited the time available for observations. Ultimately, OKB-1 decided to build a brand new Soyuz vehicle with the production designation 7KT number 33, specifically for the Orion 2 mission. This particular configuration afforded a maximum 10-day mission, with around a week fully dedicated to the operation of the telescope, even though at the cost of a considerable workload of the crew of the two cosmonauts. The entire telescope assembly was mounted under a custom-designed, unpressurized thermal cupola installed on top of the habitation module in place of the docking mechanism. The cupola was designed to protect the sensitive instrument during the ascent through upper atmosphere after the separation of the payload fairing and from heating by the sun during the orbital flight. The cosmonauts could control the telescope and roughly point it toward observation targets using a dedicated control console inside the habitation module and an optical sight mounted on one of the windows of the module right next to the control console. Using a special gimbal mechanism, the telescope then performed a more accurate pointing at the target and kept itself steady during exposure, relying on a pair of stars as navigational basis. The telescope could rotate 15 degrees each way along two axes and roll up to 10 degrees. Two shutters with electric mechanisms in the cupola were designed to open and close on command from the crew for each observation session. In addition, a backup drive could open the covers and permanently fix them in the open position as a last resort. The guidance platform of the telescope was designed to keep the instrument stable and pointing in one direction for as long as 30 minutes or during the entire pass of the spacecraft on the night side of the Earth. A pair of airlocks was installed in the semispherical bulkhead separating the unpressurized telescope section with the pressurized habitation module. They were intended for the transfer of exposed film from the telescope into the spacecraft interior for the subsequent return to Earth with the crew. On December 18, 1973, Soyuz 13 with the Orion 2 lifted off from Baikonur and entered an initial 193 by 272 kilometer orbit with an inclination of 51.6 degrees toward the equator. During the fifth orbit of the mission, the spacecraft performed a planned engine firing, delivering 12 meters per second velocity. This changed the orbit to a 226 by 272 kilometer operational orbit. Thanks to the timing of the launch, these parameters provided a period of night time lasting 36 minutes, which was optimal for mission objectives because the glare from the sun and reflected light from the Earth did not interfere with the faint starlight. Soon thereafter, the cosmonauts activated the pyrotechnics, freeing the Orion 2 telescope from its launch transport restraints. Then they performed tests of the instrument and transitioned to routine observations. Until December 25, 1973, the Soyuz 13 crew conducted 16 lengthy observation sessions with the Orion 2 telescope on the night side of the orbit. A total of 10,000 spectra of various stars and the sun were captured. Despite being extremely busy with Orion 2, the crew also used a multispectral camera to photograph the Earth's surface in 9 optical and near-infrared ranges during daylight. They also used a manual spectrograph to image the Earth's horizon in daylight and at dusk to measure the dust content in the atmosphere. Several life science experiments were also conducted. After a week of successful work, it was time to wrap it up and transfer the exposed film from the vacuum of space into the pressurized compartment. The cassette containing the star imagery from the main telescope was successfully extracted, but the units with observations from the G27 and G27A and G35 instruments stuck at the entry point into their airlock. The cosmonauts spent much of the night before landing trying to resolve the problem, but to no avail. The return to Earth was scheduled for the 129th orbit of the Soyuz 13 mission on December 26, 1973. Soyuz 13 initiated the braking maneuver at 11:08 Moscow time, reducing its orbital velocity by 95 meters per second. The separated descent module of the Soyuz 13 then successfully landed around 200 kilometers southwest of Karaganda in Kazakhstan on December 26, 1973 at 11:50 Moscow time after a nearly 8-day flight. The recovered film from the Orion 2 telescope was successfully processed on January 6, 1974. And for the first time, the Soviet astrophysicist had such a massive collection of ultraviolet spectral from faint celestial objects to keep them busy for many years. The most interesting were 3 shots produced on December 22, 1973, imaging areas of the sky around the star Capella, achieving maximum resolution. The frames captured spectra from around 2,000 stars, with only a fraction of them registered in the contemporary catalogs. Orion 2 also captured the first ultraviolet spectrum of a planetary nebula. Several stars with mysterious spectacular characteristics were also identified in the images. Interestingly, the Soyuz 13 mission coincided with the 3rd exhibition aboard NASA's Skylab space station, and some of the astronomical observations from the U.S. lab imaged the same astronomical objects, which made it possible to compare the results. The Orion 2 mission also demonstrated the adaptability of the Soyuz spacecraft for various mission objectives and paved the way for the development of new scientific instruments to be installed on piloted vehicles.
Yeah.
Salutations from the foothills of North Carolina on the shores of the mighty Yadkin River. This is Michael Annis, your host, and I wanted to say thanks for listening to episode number 435 of the Space Rocket History Podcast entitled Soyuz 12 and 13. Our next episode should be released on or about Saturday, April 6th. That is 3 weeks away because we are taking a vacation. We haven't had one for 2.5 years. And I have been working 7 days a week on the podcast and my school teaching. And my wife is still teaching and caring for her mother, so we're pretty tired. If you would like to be notified by email when new episodes are posted, you can subscribe to the blog by going to the homepage, spacerockethistory.com, and typing in your email in the text box on the right side of the page. If you're looking for old episodes, the first 253 are available on the Archive Podcast. Search for Space Rocket History Archive. It should be available on most podcatchers. You have to put in the word archive in your search. Here's another reminder. If you are using Google Podcast, you should look for an alternative, as Google is discontinuing their Google Podcast soon. So it's going to go away. So you need to find another podcatcher. Be sure to follow me on Twitter, now X. My handle is at Space Rocket Hist, and you can follow me on Facebook and Patreon by searching for Space Rocket History. I have had some new listeners asking questions about the podcast, and I wanted to mention again that we have a video that pretty much explains the scope, the timeline approach, how I select what gets covered, and the format for the podcast. The video is titled The 400th Episode Celebration. To view it, you can go to the homepage, spacerockethistory.com, and click on the YouTube link, and that should take you directly to our video. The link is on the right side of the page, about the fifth box down, I think. If you are a new listener, I really want to encourage you to check this out because it will probably answer some of the questions that you have. So go ahead and click the link. I had a few afterthoughts as usual. I do want to apologize for my mispronunciations. I really struggle with the pronunciation of these Russian names, as you can plainly hear. I'm sorry. I just struggle. I'm just kind of a North Carolinian, and that's the way it comes out. I'm not used to them. First off, or I guess second off, I would like to congratulate SpaceX on a very successful Starship flight. This was the third mission I'm referring to. They far exceeded their previous two flights. They eventually lost the hardware, but the second stage made it to space almost to orbit, and they could have put it in orbit had they so desired, but they chose not to for safety concerns. They didn't want to get it in orbit, not be able to get it back out of orbit in a safe manner where it wouldn't fall on anybody. So they chose, I mean, it was almost in orbit. It wouldn't take much to push it. They had to run the engines a little longer. They were able to they had a lot of goals, you know. They're sort of, let's try this, and if that works, that's good. If it doesn't work, we'll fix it. So that's kind of philosophy. They had several goals, and they were able to transfer fuel, and the payload bay door was open kind of successfully. I think it had a little trouble closing. There was a great, I am talking great, video coverage of this flight all the way to the end when the second stage burned up in the atmosphere. It got a little out of control at the end as it was coming back to Earth, and I think the tiles were not facing down. It wasn't in the right attitude when it was going through the atmosphere, and You got to see it heat up there. You could see it turn red, and then we lost pitcher, so I guess it kind of burned. But that was as far as SpaceX has gotten with this one, and that's quite an accomplishment in such a short amount of time to get a new vehicle up. If you would want, you would like to see it, now it's on YouTube. That's where I saw it. And, you know, I think Spaceflight Now has it on their website, and you would think SpaceX would probably have it on their site as well. I'm not certain of that, but you would think so. Well, anyway, I just wanted to give SpaceX a big shout out and congratulations from the Space Rocket History Podcast. I spent some time on the biographies of these Soviet cosmonauts, as I usually do for a space flight. Now, I know these were not household names in the U.S. and U.K. and Australia and other English-speaking countries, but their accomplishments were so impressive, I just wanted to honor them on the podcast. So if that ever gets boring to you, feel free to just fast forward over the parts you don't want to hear. But be careful. You might miss something interesting, like the aborted flight of Soyuz 18A, which I talked a little bit about, when the cosmonauts had to experience a 21G force, that's 21 times the effect of gravity, return to the Earth after they aborted their flight. It took about 21 minutes into the flight, and they had to abort. It's no wonder that Lazarev never flew again in space. His injuries were just too much, but he was on some backup crews after that. But he never got a mission after that, and he failed his physical in 81, so he was out after that. Also mentioned several Cosmos-designated missions. It appears to me that the Cosmos moniker, the first name whenever a mission gets Cosmos 355 or Cosmos 573, when you get a moniker like that, it usually means that it's a failed mission or a secret mission or a mission the Soviets just don't want to talk about for some reason or another. It's not always the case, but that is what I have noticed so far. In personal news, nothing is really new. I think I've got the 100-day cough because I've had this cough for so long. It's hard to get rid of. They're calling it now the 100-day cough. So I've still got it. I went to the doctor and he prescribed some penicillin. Anyway, I don't think that's helped any. So, and we're getting into allergy season now, so that'll probably continue along nicely. My mother-in-law was about the same. No setbacks. She continues to require pretty much 24/7 accompaniment. She can't stay on her own at night either, so our goal is still for her to reach the point where she doesn't need 24/7 coverage, because it's after a while it gets pretty tiring for my wife and her sister as well. So we're hoping we can move along to that or something. Okay, moving on to financial support. We were a little weak on the financial support over the past fortnight. We had three new donations, and I am certainly happy about that. I would like to thank James M. from Illinois, who donated at the Orion level and earned a space communication dish emoji. Dwayne H. from Elkhorn, Wisconsin, donated at the Apollo level and earned a satellite emoji. And Alan M. from Michigan donated at the Gemini level and earned a shooting star emoji. Our Patreon's donors are currently at 222. And we'll have another monthly credit card problem, I'd imagine, as we usually do. But we are at 222. Our total donors have reached, that includes Venmo, Zelle, checks, PayPal, Patreon, everybody, have reached 254, which is pretty low for the year so far. Our goal is to reach 400, but I'm questioning if we can make that for 2024. So if you are enjoying this podcast, it's been running now for 11 years without commercial interruption, and you can't afford it, please consider going to the homepage at spacerockethistory.com and clicking on the orange donate button or the Patreon link, or you can donate by check. You can also donate on Venmo or Zelle by using my email address, spacerockethistory@gmail.com. And by the way, if you began the emoji maneuver last year, now's an excellent time to complete it. And today, I would like to give a shout out to all those who promoted to the alien emoji for 7 years of financial support. This year, you get promoted to the alien emoji. Thank you for 7 years. Martin G., Dave H., D.B., Matthew F., Stephen G., Peter Y., Jacob D., Jim S., Jim B., John N., Angelo D., Don E., Yepe F., Jeffrey H., Abby L., Matthew M., Simon P., Jeff R., Randy R., Shelby R., Josh A., Tony J., Jerry A., Richard C., Daniel M., M. Olson, Christopher B., Carl H., Michael K., Ken K., Nick M., Paul N., Andrew S., Matthew T., Elaine D., Evan J., Todd K., Muriel L., Justin M., Ben R., Scott, Friends S., we sincerely thank you for sticking with us for 7 years of support. Now, it is my pleasure and honor to introduce to you Mrs. SRH with this episode's donor giveaway.
Thanks, Mike. Hello, Space Rocket History friends. The winner for this episode will get the choice of the SRH archive magnet, or two stickers, or a NASA meatball sticker. With the help of Google's random number generator, I selected Tony Joe. Tony Joe, if you will email us, spacerockethistory@gmail.com, tell us your address and your SRH prize preference, we'll get this out to you. Sincere thanks to all who have contributed so far in 2024.
My sources for this episode were NASA, Beyond Earth, A Chronicle of Deep Space Exploration, by Asif A. Sadiq, Rockets and People by Boris Chertok, Astronics.com, The Britannica, Space Facts, the website, RussiaSpaceWeb.com, Flickr, and Wikipedia. Okay, that's all I have for this episode. I hope to have episode 436 posted on or about April 6th. So long for now.